become Emperor of Fantastica, and for that he would make Atreyu repent. The joints of Bastion's metallic steed ground and creaked louder and louder, but still it obeyed its rider's will. Bastion rode for hours and hours through the endless night. In his mind's eye he saw the flaming ivory tower. Over and over he lived the moment when Atreyu had set the point of his sword to his chest. And then, for the first time, he asked himself why Atreyu had hesitated. Why, after all that had happened, couldn't he bring himself to strike Bastion and take Orin by force? And suddenly Bastion thought of the wound he had inflicted on Atreyu, and the look in Atreyu's eyes as he staggered and fell. Bastion put Sikander, which up until then he had been clutching in his fist, back into its rusty sheath. In the first light of dawn, he saw he was on a heath. Dark clumps of juniper suggested motionless groups of gigantic hooded monks or magicians with pointed hats. And then suddenly, in the midst of a frantic gallop, Bastion's metal steed burst into pieces. Bastion lay stunned by the violence of his fall. When he finally picked himself up and rubbed his bruised limbs, he found himself in the middle of a juniper bush. He crawled out into the open. The fragments of the horse lay scattered all about, as though an equestrian monument had exploded. Bastion stood up, threw his black mantle over his shoulders, and with no idea where he was going, started walking in the direction of the rising sun. But a glittering object was left behind in the juniper bush, the belt Gemahl. Bastion was unaware of his loss and never thought of the belt again. Ilwan had saved it from the flames for nothing. A few days later, Gemahl was found by a blackbird who had no suspicion of what this glittering object might be. She carried it to her nest. But that's the beginning of another story that shall be told another time. At midday, Bastion came to a high earthen wall that cut across the heath. He climbed to the top of it. Behind it, in a crater-like hollow, lay a city. At least the quantity of buildings made Bastion think of a city, but it was certainly the weirdest one he had ever seen. The buildings seemed to be jumbled every which way, without rhyme or reason, as though they had been emptied at random out of a giant sack. There were neither streets nor squares, nor was there any recognizable order. And the buildings themselves were crazy. They had front doors in their roofs, stairways which were quite inaccessible, and ended in the middle of nowhere. Towers slanted, balconies dangled vertically. There were doors where one would have expected windows, and floors in the place of walls. Bridges stopped halfway, as though the builders had suddenly forgotten what they were doing. There were towers bent like bananas, and pyramids standing on their tips. In short, the whole city seemed to have gone mad. Then Bastion saw the inhabitants, men, women, and children. They were built like ordinary human beings, but dressed as if they had lost the power to distinguish between clothing and objects intended for other purposes. On their heads, they wore lampshades, sand pails, soup bowls, waste paper baskets, or shoe boxes. Their bodies were swathed in towels, carpets, big sheets of wrapping paper, or barrels. Many were pushing or pulling handcarts with all sorts of junk piled up on them, broken lamps, mattresses, dishes, rags, and knick-knacks. Others were carrying enormous bales slung over their shoulders. The farther Bastion went into the city, the thicker became the crowd. But none of the people seemed to know where they were going. Several times Bastion saw someone dragging a heavily laden cart in one direction, then after a short time doubling back, and a few minutes later changing direction again. Everybody was feverishly active. Bastion decided to speak to one of these people. "What's the name of this place?" The person let go his cart, straightened up, and scratched his head for a while as though thinking it over. Then he went away, abandoning his cart, which he seemed to have forgotten. But a few minutes later, a woman took hold of the cart and started off with it. Bastion asked her if the junk was hers, The woman stood for a while deep in thought. Then she too went away. Bastian tried a few more times, but received no answer. Suddenly he heard someone giggling.
"No point in asking them," said the giggler. "They can't tell you anything. One might, in a manner of speaking, call them the know-nothings."
Bastian turned toward the voice and saw a little grey monkey sitting on a window ledge, or rather on what would have been a window ledge if the window hadn't been upside down. The animal was wearing a mortarboard with a dangling tassel and seemed to be busy counting something on his fingers and toes. When he had finished, he grinned and said,
"Sorry to keep you waiting, sir, but there was something I had to figure out."
"Who are you?" Bastian asked.
"My name is Argax," said the little monkey, lifting his mortarboard. "Pleased to meet you. And with whom have I the pleasure?"
"My name is Bastian Balthasar Books."
"Just as I thought," said the monkey, visibly pleased.
"And what is the name of this city?" Bastian inquired.
"It hasn't actually got a name," said Argax, "but one might, in a manner of speaking, call it the City of the Old Emperors."
"Old Emperors?" Bastian repeated with consternation. "Why, I don't see anybody who looks like an old emperor."
"You don't?" said the monkey with a giggle. "Well, believe it or not, all the people you've seen were emperors of Fantastica in their time. Or wanted to be."
Bastian was aghast. "How do you know that, Argax?" The monkey lifted his mortarboard and grinned.
"I, in a manner of speaking, am the superintendent here."
Bastian looked around. Not far away, an old man had dug a pit. He put a lighted candle into it, then shoveled earth over the candle. The monkey giggled.
"What would you say to a little tour of the town, sir, to get acquainted, in a manner of speaking, with your future residents?"
"No," said Bastian.
"What are you talking about?"
The monkey jumped up on his shoulder.
"Let's go," he whispered. "It's free of charge. You've already paid the admission fee."
Bastian obeyed the monkey's orders, though he would rather have run away. He grew more miserable with every step. He watched the people and was struck by the fact that they didn't talk. They were all so busy with their own concerns that they didn't even seem to see one another.
"What's wrong with them?" Bastian asked. "Why are they so odd?" "Nothing odd about them," said Argax. "They're just like you, in a manner of speaking. Or rather, they were in their time."
Bastian stopped in his tracks.
"What do you mean by that? Do you mean that they're humans?"
Argax jumped up and down on Bastian's shoulder.
"Exactly," he said gleefully.
Bastian saw a woman in the middle of the street trying to spear peas with a darning needle.
"How did they get here? What are they doing here?" "Oh, there have always been humans who couldn't find their way back to their world," Argax explained. "First, they didn't want to, and now, in a manner of speaking, they can't."
Bastian looked at a little girl who was struggling to push a doll's carriage with square wheels.
"Why can't they?" he asked. "They'd have to wish it, and they've stopped wishing. They used up their last wish for something else."
"Their last wish?" said Bastian, going deathly pale. "Can't a person go on wishing as long as he pleases?" Argax giggled again. Then he tried to take off Bastian's turban and pick lice out of his hair. "Stop that," Bastian cried. He tried to shake the little monkey off, but Argax held on tight and squealed with pleasure.
"No, no," he chattered. "You can only wish as long as you remember your world. These people here used up all their memories. Without a past, you can't have a future. That's why they don't get older. Just look at them. Would you believe that some of them have been here 1,000 years and more? But they stay just as they are. Nothing can change for them, because they themselves can't change any more."
Bastian watched a man who had lathered a mirror and was starting to shave it. Once that might have struck him as funny. Now it made him break out in goose flesh. He hurried on and soon realized that he was going deeper into the city. He wanted to turn back, but something drew him onward like a magnet. He began to run and tried to get rid of the bothersome grey monkey. But Argax clung fast and even spurred him on.
Faster! Faster!
Bastian stopped running. He realized that he couldn't escape.
You mean,
he asked, gasping for breath,
that all these people here were once emperors of Fantastica, or wanted to be?
That's it, said Argax.
All the ones who can't find their way back try sooner or later to become emperor. They don't all make it, but they all tried. That's why there are two kinds of fools here, though the result, in a manner of speaking, is the same.
What two kinds? Tell me, Argax, I have to know.
Easy does it, said the monkey, giggling as he tightened his grip on Bastian's neck. The one kind gradually used up their memories, and when they had lost the last one, Orin couldn't fulfill their wishes any more. After that, they came here, in a manner of speaking, automatically. The others, the ones who crowned themselves emperor, lost all their memories at one stroke. So the same thing happened. Orin couldn't fulfill their wishes any more, because they had none left. As you see, it comes to the same thing. Here they are, and they can't get away.
Do you mean that they all had Orin at one time?
Naturally, said Argax, but they forgot it long ago, and it wouldn't help them any more, the poor fools.
Was it? Bastian hesitated. Was it taken away from them?
No, said Argax. When someone crowns himself emperor, it simply vanishes. Obviously, because how, in a manner of speaking, can you use Moonchild's power to take her power away from her?
Bastian felt wretched. He would have liked to sit down somewhere, but the little grey monkey wouldn't let him.
No, no, our tour isn't done yet. The best is yet to come. Keep moving!
Bastian saw a boy with a heavy hammer trying to drive nails into a pair of socks. A fat man was trying to paste postage stamps on soap bubbles. They kept bursting, but he went on blowing new ones.
Look!
Bastian heard the giggling voice of Argax and felt his head being twisted by the monkey's little hands.
Look over there! It's so amusing!
Bastian saw a large group of people, men and women, young and old, all in the strangest clothes. They didn't speak. Each one was alone with himself. On the ground lay a large number of cubes, and there were letters on all six sides of the cubes. The people kept jumbling the cubes and then staring at them.
What are they doing?
Bastian whispered.
What sort of game is that? It's called the jumble game, answered Argax.
He motioned to the players and cried out,
Good work, children! Keep at it! Don't give up!
Then turning back to Bastian, he whispered in his ear,
They can't talk any more. They've lost the power of speech. So I thought up this game for them. As you see, it keeps them busy. It's very simple. If you stop to think about it, you'll have to admit that all the stories in the world consist essentially of 26 letters. The letters are always the same, only the arrangement varies. From letters, words are formed. From words, sentences. From sentences, chapters. And from chapters, stories. Now take a look. What do you see there?
Bastian read, HGIKLOPFMASDFGHJKLOA QWERTZUIOPU ASDFGHJKLOA MNBVCXY LKJHGFDSA UPOIUZTREWQASERTZUIOPUASDFGHJKLOA YXC
UPOIUZTREWQAOLKJHGFDSAMNBV GKHDSRZIP QETUOUSFHKO YCBMWRZIP ARCGUNIKYO QERTZIOP LUASD MNBVCXY ASD LKJUON GREF GHI.
Yes, of course, said Argax with a giggle. It usually makes no more sense than that. But if you keep at it for a long time, words turn up now and then. Not very brilliant words, but still words. Spinach cramp, for instance, or sugar brush, or nose polish. And if you play for 100 years, or 1,000, or 100,000, the law of chances tells us that a poem will probably come out. And if you play it forever, every possible poem and every possible story will have to come out. In fact, every story about a story, and even this story about the two of us chatting here. It's only logical, don't you think?
It's horrible, said Bastian.
I wouldn't say that, said Argax. It depends on your point of view. It keeps these people, in a manner of speaking, busy. And anyway, what else can we do with them in Fantastica?
For a long time, Bastian watched the players in silence. Then he asked under his breath, Argax, you know who I am, don't you?
Of course I do. Is there anyone in Fantastica who doesn't?
Tell me one thing, Argax. If I had become emperor yesterday, would I already be here now?
Today or tomorrow, said the monkey, or next week. One way or another, you'd have ended up here.
Then Atreyu saved me?
You've got me there,
the monkey admitted. But if he had succeeded in taking the gem away from me, what would have happened then? The monkey giggled again.
You'd have ended up here, in a manner of speaking, all the same.
Why?
Because you need Orin to find the way back. But frankly, I don't believe you'll make it.
The monkey clapped his little hands, lifted his mortarboard, and grinned. Tell me, Argax, what must I do?
Find a wish that will take you back to your world.
After a long silence, Bastian asked, Argax, can you tell me how many wishes I have left?
Not very many. In my opinion, 3 or 4 at the most. And that will hardly be enough. You're beginning rather late, and the way back isn't easy. You'll have to cross the Sea of Mist. That alone will cost you a wish. What comes next, I don't know. No one in Fantastica knows what road you people must take to get back to your world. Maybe you'll find yours, Minrud. That's the last hope for people like you. But I'm afraid that for you it's, in a manner of speaking, too far. Be that as it may, you will, just this once, find your way out of the city of the old emperors.
Thanks, Argax, said Bastian. The little grey monkey grinned.
Goodbye, Bastian Balthazar Books.
With one leap, Argax vanished into one of the crazy houses. He had taken Bastian's turban with him. For a while, Bastian stood motionless. He was so stunned by what he had just heard that he couldn't decide what to do. All his plans had collapsed at one stroke. His thoughts seemed to have been stood on end, like the pyramid he had seen. What he had hoped was his ruin, and what he had feared his salvation. At the moment, only one thing was clear to him. He must get out of this insane city and never come back. He started through the jumble of crazy buildings. He soon discovered that it was much harder to get out than to get in. Time and again he lost his way and found himself back in the center of the city. It took him all afternoon to reach the earthworks. Then he ran out into the heath and kept going until black night, as black as the night before, forced him to stop. Exhausted, he collapsed under a juniper tree and fell into a deep sleep. And while he slept, the memory that he could once make up stories left him. All night he had the same unchanging vision before his eyes. Atreyu, with the gaping wound in his chest, stood there, looking at him in silence. Awakened by a thunderclap, Bastian started up. Deep darkness lay all around him, but the massive clouds that had been gathering for days had been thrown into wild disorder. Lightning flashed, thunder shook the earth, the storm wind howled over the heath, and the juniper trees were bowed to the ground. Rain fell in dense sheets. Bastian arose and stood there wrapped in his black mantle. The water ran down his face. Lightning struck a tree directly in front of him and split the gnarled bark. The branches went up in flames, the wind blew a shower of sparks over the heath. In a moment they were doused by the rain. The crash had thrown Bastian to his knees. He dug into the earth with both hands. When the hole was big enough, he unslung the sword Sikander and put it in. "Sikander," he said, "I am taking leave of you forever. Never again shall anyone draw you against a friend. No one shall find you here until what you and I have done is forgotten." He filled in the hole and covered it over with moss and branches, lest anyone should discover it. And there Sikander lies to this day. For not until far in the future will one come who can wield it without danger. But that is another story, and shall be told another time. Bastian went his way through the darkness. Toward morning the storm abated, the wind died down, and there was no other sound than the rain dripping from the trees. That night was the beginning of a long, lonely journey for Bastian. He no longer wished to return to his traveling companions, Orc Zeid. Now he wanted to find the way back to the human world, but he didn't know how or where to look for it. Was there somewhere a gate, a bridge, a mountain pass that would take him back? He had to wish for it, he knew, but he had no power over his wishes. He felt like a diver who was searching the bottom of the sea for a sunken ship, but keeps being driven to the surface before he can find anything. He also knew that he had few wishes left, so he was careful not to use Orin. He was determined to sacrifice his last few remaining memories only if he felt sure that this would help him to get back to his world. But wishes cannot be summoned up or kept away at will. They come from deeper within us than good or bad intentions, and they spring up unannounced. And so, before he knew it, a new wish arose within him, and little by little took form. For days and nights he had been wandering all alone, and because of being alone he yearned to belong to some sort of community, to be taken into a group, not as a master or victor, or as any special sort of person, but merely as one among many, perhaps as the smallest or least important, provided his membership in the community was unquestioned. And then one day he came to a sea coast, or so he thought at first. He was standing on the edge of a sheer cliff, and before him lay a sea of congealed white waves. It was some time before he realized that these waves were not really motionless, but were moving very slowly, that there were currents and eddies that moved as imperceptibly as the hands of a clock. He had come to the sea of mist. Bastian walked along the cliff. The air was warm and slightly damp. There was not the slightest breeze. It was early morning, and the sun shone on the snow-white surface of the fog, which extended to the horizon. He walked for several hours. Toward noon he espied a small town some distance from the shore. Supported by piles, it formed a sort of island in the sea of mist. The long arching bridge connecting the town with the rocky coast swayed gently as Bastian crossed it. The houses were relatively small. The doors, windows, and stairways all seemed to have been made for children. and indeed the people moving about the streets were no bigger than children, though they all seemed to be grown men with beards or women with pinned-up hair. As Bastian soon noticed, these people looked so much alike that he could hardly tell them apart. Their faces were dark brown like moist earth, and they looked calm and gentle. When they saw Bastian, they nodded to him, but none spoke. Altogether, they seemed a silent lot. The place was humming with activity, yet he seldom heard a cry or a spoken word. And never did he see any of these people alone. They always went about in groups, if not in crowds, locking arms or holding one another by the hand. When Bastian examined the houses more closely, he saw that they were all made of a sort of wicker, some crude and some of a finer weave, and that the streets were paved with the same kind of material. Even the people's clothing, he noticed, their trousers, skirts, jackets and hats, were of wickerwork, though these were artfully woven. Everything in the town seemed to be made of the same material. Here and there, Bastian was able to cast a glance into the artisans' workshops. They were all busy weaving, making shoes, pitchers, lamps, cups, and umbrellas of wickerwork. But never did he see anyone working alone, for these things could be made only by several persons working together. It was a pleasure to see how cleverly they coordinated their movements, and as they worked, they usually sang some simple melody without words. The town was not very large, and Bastian had soon come to the edge of it. There he saw hundreds of ships of every size and shape. The town was a seaport, but of a most unusual kind, for all these ships were hanging from gigantic fishing poles and hovered, swaying gently, over a chasm full of swirling white mist. These ships, made of wickerwork like everything else, had neither sails nor masts, nor oars nor rudders. Bastian leaned over the railing and looked down into the sea of mist. He was able to gauge the length of the stakes supporting the town by the shadows they cast on the white surface below. "At night," he heard a voice beside him say, "the mists rise to the level of the town. Then we can put out to sea. In the daytime, the sun reduces the mist and the level falls. That's what you wanted to know, isn't it, stranger?" Three men were leaning against the railing beside Bastian. They seemed gentle and friendly. They got talking, and in the course of his conversation with them, Bastian learned that the town was called Uskal, or Basketville. Its inhabitants were known as Uskalnari. The word meant roughly the partners. The three were mist sailors. Not wishing to give his name for fear of being recognized, Bastian introduced himself as Someone. The three sailors told him the Uskalnari had no names for individuals and didn't find it necessary. They were all Uskalnari, and that was enough for them. Since it was lunchtime, they invited Bastian to join them, and he gratefully accepted. They went to a nearby inn, and during the meal, Bastian learned all about Basketville and its inhabitants. The sea of mist, which they called the Skydan, was an enormous ocean of white vapor, which divided the two parts of Fantastica from each other. No one had ever found out how deep the Skydan was, or where all this mist came from. It was quite possible to breathe below the surface of the mist and to walk some distance on the bottom of the sea near the coast, where the mist was relatively shallow, but only if one was tied to a rope and could be pulled back. For the mist had one strange property. It fuddled one's sense of direction. Any number of fools and daredevils had died in the attempt to cross the Skydan alone and on foot. Only a few had been rescued. The only way to reach the other side was in the ships of the Uskalnari. The wickerwork, from which the houses, implements, clothing, and ships of Uskal were made, was woven from a variety of rushes that grew under the surface of the sea, not far from the shore. These rushes, as can easily be gathered from the foregoing, could be cut only at the risk of one's life. Though unusually pliable, and even limp in ordinary air, they stood upright in the sea, because they were lighter than the mist. That was what made the wickerwork ships mistworthy. and if any of the Uskalnari chanced to fall into the mist, his regular clothing served the purpose of a life jacket. But the strangest thing about the Uskalnari, so it struck Bastian, was that the word I seemed unknown to them. In any case, they never used it, but in speaking of what they thought or did, always said we. When he gathered from the conversation that the three sailors would be putting out to sea that night, he asked if he could ship with them as a cabin boy. They informed him that a voyage on the Skydarn was very different from any other ocean voyage, because no one knew how long it would take, or exactly where it would end up. When Bastian said that didn't worry him, they agreed to take him on. At nightfall, the mists began to rise, and by midnight they had reached the level of Basketville. The ships that had been dangling in mid-air were now floating on the white surface. The moorings of the one on which Bastian found himself, a flat barge about 100 feet long, were cast off, and it drifted slowly out into the sea of mist. The moment he laid his eyes on it, Bastian wondered what propelled this sort of ship, since it had neither sails nor oars nor propeller. He soon found out that sails would have been useless, for there was seldom any wind on the Skydarn, and that oars and propellers do not function in mist. These ships were moved by an entirely different sort of power. In the middle of the deck, there was a round, slightly raised platform. Bastian had noticed it from the start and taken it for a sort of captain's bridge. Indeed, it was occupied throughout the voyage by two or more sailors. The entire crew numbered 14. The men on the platform held one another clasped by the shoulders and looked fixedly forward. At first sight, they seemed to be standing motionless. Actually, they were swaying very slowly, in perfect unison, in a sort of dance, which they accompanied by chanting over and over again a simple and strangely beautiful tune. At first, Bastian regarded this song and dance as some sort of ceremony, the meaning of which escaped him. Then, on the third day of the voyage, he asked one of his three friends about it. Evidently surprised at Bastian's ignorance, the sailor explained that those men were propelling the ship by thought power. More puzzled than ever, Bastian asked if some sort of hidden wheels were set in motion.
"No," one of the sailors replied. "When you want to move your legs, you have only to think about it. You don't need wheels, do you?"
The only difference between a person's body and a ship was that to move a ship, at least two Iskalnari had to merge their thought powers into one. It was this fusion of thought powers that propelled the ship. If greater speed was desired, more men had to join in. Normally, thinkers worked in shifts of three. The others rested, for easy and pleasant as it looked, thought propulsion was hard work, demanding intense and unbroken concentration. But there was no other way of sailing the Skydarn. Bastian became the student of the mist navigators, and learned the secret of their cooperation, dance and song without words. Little by little, in the course of the long voyage, he became one of them. During the dance, he felt his thought power merging with those of his companions to form a whole, and this gave him a strange and indescribable sense of harmony and self-forgetfulness. He felt accepted by a community, at one with his companions, and at the same time he totally forgot that the inhabitants of the world from which he came, and to which he was seeking the way back, were human beings, each with his own thoughts and opinions. Dimly he remembered his home and parents, but nothing more. His wish to be no longer alone had come true. But now, deep in his heart, a new wish arose, and began to make itself felt. One day it struck him that the Iskalnari lived together so harmoniously, not because they blended different ways of thinking, but because they were so much alike that it cost them no effort to form a community. Indeed, they were incapable of quarreling or even disagreeing, because they did not regard themselves as individuals. Thus there were no conflicts or differences to overcome, and it was just this sameness this absence of stress that gradually came to pall on Bastian. Their gentleness bored him, and the unchanging melody of their songs got on his nerves. He felt that something was lacking, something he hungered for, but he could not yet have said what it was. This became clear to him some time later when a giant mist crow was sighted. Stricken with terror, the sailors vanished below deck as fast as they could, but one was not quick enough. A monstrous bird swooped down with a cry, seized the poor fellow, and carried him away in its beak. When the danger was past, the sailors emerged and resumed their song and dance as though nothing had happened. Their harmony was undisturbed, and far from grieving, they didn't waste so much as a word on the incident. "Why should we grieve?" said one of them when Bastian inquired. "None of us is missing." With them, the individual counted for nothing. No one was irreplaceable, because they drew no distinction between one man and another. Bastian, however, wanted to be an individual, a someone, not just one among others. He wanted to be loved for being just what he was. In this community of Iskalnari, there was harmony, but no love. He no longer wanted to be the greatest, strongest, or cleverest. He had left all that far behind. He longed to be loved just as he was, good or bad, handsome or ugly, clever or stupid, with all his faults, or possibly because of them. But what was he actually like? He no longer knew. So much had been given to him in Fantastica, and now, among all these gifts and powers, he could no longer find himself. He stopped dancing with the mist sailors. All day long, and sometimes all night as well, he sat in the prow, looking out over the sky down. At last, the crossing was completed, and the mist ship docked. Bastian thanked the Uskalnari and went ashore. This was a land full of roses. There were whole forests of roses of every imaginable color. A winding path led through the endless rose garden, and Bastian followed it. 24. Dame Iola. Zayide's end is soon told, but hard to understand and full of contradictions, like many things in Fantastica. To this day, many scholars and historians are racking their brains for an explanation of what happened, while some deny the whole incident or try to interpret it out of existence. Here we shall simply state the facts, leaving others to explain them as best they can. Just as Bastian was arriving at the town of Uskal, Zayide and her black giants reached the spot where his metallic horse had collapsed under him. In that moment, she suspected that she would never find him, and her suspicions became a certainty when she came to the earthen wall and saw Bastian's footprints on it. If he had reached the city of the old emperors, he was lost to her plans, regardless of whether he stayed there or whether he managed to escape. In the first case, he would become powerless, like everyone there, no longer able to wish for anything. And in the second, all wishes for power and greatness would die within him. For her, Zayide, the game was over in either case. She commanded her armored giants to halt. Strangely, they did not obey, but marched on. She flew into a rage, jumped out of her litter, and ran after them with outstretched arms. The armored giants, foot soldiers and riders alike, ignored her commands, turned about, and trampled her with their feet and hooves. At length, when Zayide had breathed her last, the whole column stopped, like run-down clockwork. When Husbolt, Hudorn and Hukrian arrived with what was left of the army, they saw what had happened. They were puzzled, because they knew it was Zayide's will alone that had moved the hollow giants. So, they thought, it must have been her will that they should trample her to death. But knotty problems were not the knight's forte, so in the end they shrugged their shoulders and let well enough alone. But what were they to do next? They talked it over, and deciding that the campaign was at an end, discharged the army, and advised everyone to go home. They themselves, however, felt bound by the oath of fealty they had sworn to Bastian, and resolved to search all Fantastica for him. That was all well and good, but which way were they to go? They couldn't agree, so deciding that each would search separately, they parted and hobbled off, each in a different direction. All three had countless adventures, and Fantastica knows numerous accounts of their futile quest. But these are other stories, and shall be told another time. For years, the hollow, black metal giants stood motionless on the heath, not far from the city of the old emperors. Rain and snow fell on them. They rusted, and little by little, sank into the ground, some vertically, some at a slant. But to this day, a few of them can be seen. The place is thought to be cursed, and travellers make a wide circle around it. But let's get back to Bastian. While following the winding path through the rose garden, he saw something that amazed him, because in all his wanderings in Fantastica, he had never seen anything like it. It was a pointing hand carved from wood. Beside it was written, "To the House of Change." Without haste, Bastian took the direction indicated. He breathed the fragrance of the innumerable roses and felt more and more cheerful, as though looking forward to a pleasant surprise. At length he came to a straight avenue, bordered by round trees laden with red-cheeked apples. At the end of the avenue, a house appeared. As he approached it, Bastian decided it was the funniest house he had ever seen. Under a tall, pointed roof that looked rather like a stocking cap, the house itself suggested a giant pumpkin. The walls were covered with large protuberances, one might almost have said bellies, that gave the house a comfortably inviting look. There were a few windows and a front door, but they seemed crooked, as though a clumsy child had cut them out. On his way to the house, Bastian saw that it was slowly but steadily changing. A small bump appeared on the right side, and gradually took the shape of a dormer window. At the same time, a window on the left side closed, and little by little disappeared. A chimney grew out of the roof, and a small balcony with a balustrade appeared over the front door. Bastian stopped still and watched the changes with surprise and amusement. Now he understood why the place was called the House of Change. As he stood there, he heard a warm, pleasant voice, a woman's, singing inside. "A hundred summers to a day, we have waited here for you, seeing that you found the way, it must certainly be you. Your hunger and your thirst to still, all is here in readiness. You shall eat and drink your fill, sheltered in our tenderness. Regardless whether good or bad, you've suffered much and travelled far, take comfort for the trials you've had. We'll have you just the way you are." "Ah," thought Bastian, "what a lovely voice! If only that song were meant for me." The voice began again to sing. "Great Lord, I pray, be small again. Be a child and come right in. Don't keep standing at the door. You are welcome here and more. Everything for many a year has been ready for you here." Bastian felt irresistibly drawn by that voice. He felt sure the singer must be a very friendly person. He knocked at the door, and the voice called out, "Come in! Come in, dear boy!" He opened the door and saw a small but comfortable room. The sun was streaming in through the windows. In the middle of the room there was a round table covered with bowls and baskets full of all sorts of fruits unknown to Bastian. At the table sat a woman as round and red-cheeked and healthy-looking as an apple. Bastian was almost overpowered by a desire to run to her with outstretched arms and cry, "Mama! Mama!" But he controlled himself. His mama was dead, and was certainly not here in Fantastica. This woman, it was true, had the same sweet smile and the same trustworthy look, but between her and his mother there was little resemblance. His mother had been small, and this woman was large and imposing. She was wearing a broad hat covered with fruits and flowers, and her dress was of some sort of bright, flowered material. It was some time before Bastian realized that it consisted of leaves, flowers, and fruits. As he stood looking at her, he was overcome by a feeling he had not known for a long time. He could not remember when and where. He knew only that he had sometimes felt this way when he was little. "Sit down, dear boy," said the woman, motioning him to a chair. "You must be hungry. Do have a bite to eat." "I beg your pardon," said Bastian. "You're expecting a guest. I've only come here by accident." "Really?" said the woman with a smile. "Oh, well, it doesn't matter. You can have a bite to eat all the same. Meanwhile, I'll tell you a little story." "Go on. Don't stand on ceremony." Bastian took off his black mantle, laid it on a chair, and hesitantly reached for a fruit. Before biting into it, he asked, "What about you? Aren't you eating? Or don't you care for fruit?" The woman laughed heartily. Bastian didn't know why. "Very well," she said, after composing herself. "If you insist, I'll have something to keep you company, but in my own way. Don't be frightened." With that, she picked up a watering can that was on the floor beside her, held it over her head, and sprinkled herself. "Oh," she said, "that is refreshing." Now it was Bastian's turn to laugh. Then he bit into the fruit and instantly realized that he had never eaten anything so good. He took a second fruit, and that was even better. "You like it?" asked the woman, watching him closely. Bastian couldn't answer because his mouth was full. He chewed and nodded. "I'm glad," the woman said. "I've taken a lot of pains with that fruit. Eat as much as you please." Bastian took a third fruit, and that was sheer delight. He sighed with well-being. "And now I'll tell you the story," said the woman. "But don't let it stop you from eating." Bastian found it hard to listen, for each new fruit gave him a more rapturous sensation than the last. "A long, long time ago," the flowery woman began, "our childlike empress was deathly ill, for she needed a new name, and only a human could give her one. But humans had stopped coming to Fantastica, no one knew why. And if she had died, that would have been the end of Fantastica. Then one day, or rather one night, a human came after all. It was a little boy, and he gave the childlike empress the name of Moonchild. She recovered, and in token of her gratitude, she promised the boy that all his wishes in her empire would come true, until he found out what he really and truly wanted. Then the little boy made a long journey from one wish to the next, and each one came true. And each fulfillment led to a new wish. There were not only good wishes, but bad ones as well. But the childlike empress drew no distinction. In her eyes, all things in her empire are equally good and important. In the end, the ivory tower was destroyed, and she did nothing to prevent it. But with every wish fulfillment, the little boy lost a part of his memory of the world he had come from. He didn't really mind, for he had given up wanting to go back. So he kept on wishing. But by then, he had spent all his memories, and without memories, it's not possible to wish. So he had almost ceased to be a human and had almost become a Fantastigan. He still didn't know what he really and truly wanted. It seemed possible that his very last memories would be used up before he found out. And if that happened, he would never be able to return to his own world. Then, at last, he came to the House of Change, and there he would stay until he found out what he really and truly wanted. You see, it's called the House of Change, not only because it changes itself, but also because it changes anyone who lives in it. And that was very important to the little boy, because up until then he had always wanted to be someone other than he was. But he didn't want to change. At this point she broke off, because her visitor had stopped chewing and was staring open-mouthed. "If that one doesn't taste good," she said with concern, "just put it down and take another." "What?" Bastian stammered. "Oh, no, it's delicious." "Then everything's fine," said the woman. "But I forgot to tell you the name of the little boy who had been expected so long at the House of Change. Many in Fantastica called him simply the Saviour, others the Knight of the Seven-Armed Candelabrum, or the Great Knower, or Lord and Master. But his real name was Bastian Balthazar Books." The woman turned to Bastian with a smile. He swallowed once or twice and said very softly, "That's my name." "Well then," said the woman, who didn't seem the least surprised. Suddenly the buds on her hat and dress burst into bloom. "But," said Bastian hesitantly, "I haven't been in Fantastica 100 years. "Oh, we've been waiting for you much longer than that," said the woman. "My grandmother and my grandmother's grandmother waited for you. You see, now someone is telling you a story that is new, even though it's about the remotest past." Bastian remembered Grogramon's words. That had been at the beginning of his journey, and now suddenly it seemed to him that 100 years had indeed elapsed since then. "By the way, I haven't introduced myself. I'm Dame Iola." Bastian repeated the name several times before he was able to pronounce it properly. Then he took another fruit. He bit into it, and as usual thought the one he was eating was the most delicious of all. But then he noticed with some alarm that there was only one left. "Do you want more?" asked Dame Iola, who had caught his glance. When Bastian nodded, she plucked fruit from her hat and dress until the bowl was full again. "Does the fruit grow on your hat?" Bastian asked in amazement. "Hat? What are you talking about?" cried Dame Iola. But then she understood and broke into a loud, hearty laugh. "So you think it's a hat I've got on my head? Not at all, dear boy. It all grows out of me, just as your hair grows out of you. That should show you how glad I am that you finally come. That's why I'm flowering and bearing fruit. If I were sad, I'd wither. But come now, don't forget to eat." Bastian was embarrassed. "I don't know," he said. "Is it all right to eat something that comes out of somebody?" "Why not?" asked Dame Iola. "Babies drink milk that comes out of their mothers. There's nothing better." "That's true," said Bastian, with a slight blush, but only when they're very little.
In that case, said Dame Iola, beaming, you'll just have to get to be very little again, my dear boy.
Bastian took another fruit and bit into it. Dame Iola was delighted and bloomed more than ever. After a short silence, she said, I think it would like us to move into the next room. I believe it may have arranged something for you.
Who?
Bastian asked, looking around.
The House of Change, said Dame Iola, as if that were the most natural thing in the world.
And indeed, a strange thing had happened. The living room had changed without Bastian noticing that anything was going on. The ceiling had moved upward, while three of the walls had come close to the table. There was still room on the fourth side, where there was a door, which now stood open. Dame Iola arose, and then he saw how big she was.
We'd better go, she suggested. It's very stubborn.
Opposition is useless if it has thought up a surprise. We may as well let it have its way. It usually means well.
Bastian followed her through the door, but took the fruit bowl with him as a precaution.
He found himself in a large dining room that looked somehow familiar. Only the furniture seemed strange. The table and especially the chairs were so large that he couldn't possibly have sat in them.
Fancy that, said Dame Iola with a chuckle. The House of Change is always thinking up something new.
Now, for your benefit, it has provided a room as it must look to a small child.
You mean, said Bastian, that this room wasn't here before?
Of course not. The House of Change is very wide awake, you see. This is its way of taking part in our conversation. I think it's trying to tell you something.
Then she sat down in one of the chairs at the table, while Bastian tried in vain to climb up on the other. Dame Iola had to pick him up and put him on it, but even then his nose was barely level with the tabletop. He was glad he had taken the bowl of fruit and kept it on his lap. If it had been on the table, it would have been beyond his reach.
Do you often have to change rooms this way? He asked.
Not often, said Dame Iola. Never more than 3 or 4 times a day. Sometimes the House of Change will have its little jokes, and then the rooms are suddenly reversed. The floor on top and the ceiling at the bottom, that sort of thing. But it's only being bumptious, and it stops when I give it a piece of my mind. All in all, it's a well-behaved house, and I feel very comfortable in it. We have good laughs together.
But isn't it dangerous? Bastian asked.
For instance, if you're asleep at night, and the room gets smaller and smaller.
What nonsense, dear boy! Cried Dame Iola, pretending to be angry. It's very fond of me, and it's fond of you, too. It's glad to have you here.
What if it takes a dislike to somebody?
No idea, she replied. What questions you ask! There's never been anyone here but you and me.
Oh, said Bastian, then I'm your first guest.
Of course.
Bastian looked around the enormous room.
This room doesn't seem to go with the house. It didn't look so big from outside.
The House of Change, said Dame Iola, is bigger inside than out.
Meanwhile, night was falling, and it was growing darker and darker in the room.
Bastian leaned back in his big chair and propped his head on his hands. He felt deliciously sleepy.
Why, he asked, did you wait so long for me, Dame Iola?
I always wanted a child, she said, a child I could spoil, who needed my tenderness, a child I could care for. Someone like you, my darling boy.
Bastian yawned. He felt irresistibly lulled by her sweet voice.
But, he objected, you said your mother and grandmother waited for me.
Dame Iola's face was now in the darkness.
Yes, he heard her say. My mother and my grandmother also wanted a child,
They never had one, but I have one now. Bastian's eyes closed. He barely managed to ask, How can that be? Your mother had you when you were little, and your grandmother had your mother. No, my darling boy, said the voice, hardly above a whisper. With us it's different. We don't die, and we're not born. We're always the same, Dame Iola. And then again, we're not. When my mother grew old, she withered. All her leaves fell, as the leaves fall from a tree in the winter. She withdrew into herself, and so she remained for a long time. But then one day she put forth young leaves, buds, blossoms, and finally fruit. And that's how I came into being, for I was the new Dame Iola. And it was just the same with my grandmother when she brought my mother into the world. We Dames Iola can only have a child if we wither first. And then we're our own child, and we can't be a mother any more. That's why I'm so glad you're here, my darling boy. Bastian spoke no more. He had slipped into a sweet half-sleep, in which he heard her words as a kind of chant. He heard her stand up and cross the room and bend over him. She stroked his hair and kissed him on the forehead. Then he felt her pick him up and carry him out in her arms. He buried his head in her bosom like a baby. Deeper and deeper he sank into the warm, sleepy darkness. He felt that he was being undressed and put into a soft, sweet-smelling bed. And then he heard her lovely voice singing far in the distance. Sleep, my darling, good night. Your sufferings are past. Great Lord, be a little child at last. Sleep, my darling, sleep tight. When he woke up the next morning, he felt better and happier than ever before. He looked around and saw that he was in a cozy little room, lying in a crib. Actually, it was a very large crib, or rather it was as large as a crib must look to a baby. For a moment this struck him as ridiculous, because he certainly wasn't a baby any more, and he was still in possession of all the powers and gifts that Fantastica had given him. The childlike Empress's amulet was still hanging from his neck. But in the very next moment he stopped caring whether it was ridiculous or not. No one but him and Dame Iola would ever find out. And they both knew that everything was just as it should be. He got up, washed, dressed, and left the room. A flight of wooden steps took him to the big dining room, which had turned into a kitchen overnight. Dame Iola had breakfast all ready for him. She too was in high spirits. Her flowers were in full bloom. She sang and laughed and even danced around the kitchen table with him. After breakfast, she sent him outside to get some fresh air. In the great rose garden around the House of Change, it was summer, a summer that seemed eternal. Bastian sauntered about, watched the bees feasting on the flowers, listened to the birds that were singing in every rosebush, played with the lizards, which were so tame that they crawled up on his hand, and with the hares, which let him stroke them. From time to time he crept under a bush, smelled the sweet scent of the roses, blinked up at the sun, and thinking of nothing in particular, let the time glide by like a brook. Days became weeks. He paid no attention. Dame Iola was merry, and Bastian surrendered himself to her motherly care and tenderness. It seemed to him that without knowing it, he had long hungered for something which was now being given him in abundance, and he just couldn't get enough of it. He spent whole days rummaging through the house of change from attic to cellar. He never got bored because the rooms were always changing, and there was always something new to discover. Clearly the house was at pains to entertain its guest. It produced playrooms, railway trains, puppet theatres, jungle gyms. There was even a big merry-go-round. Or else he would explore the surrounding country. But he never went too far from the House of Change, for suddenly he would be overcome by a craving for Dame Iola's fruit. And when that happened, he could hardly wait to get back to her and eat his fill. In the evening, they had long talks. He told her about all his adventures in Fantastica, about Perelin and Grogramon, about Xeaid and Atreyu, whom he had wounded so cruelly, and perhaps even killed. "I did everything wrong," he said. "I misunderstood everything. Moonchild gave me so much, and all I did with it was harm. Harm to myself, and harm to Fantastica." Dame Iola gave him a long look. "No," she said, "I don't believe so. You went the way of wishes, and that is never straight. You went the long way around, but that was your way. And do you know why? Because you are one of those who can't go back until they have found the fountain from which springs the water of life. And that's the most secret place in Fantastica. There's no simple way of getting there." After a short silence, she added, "But every way that leads there is the right one." Suddenly, Bastian began to cry. He didn't know why. He felt as if a knot in his heart had come open and dissolved into tears. He sobbed and he sobbed and couldn't stop. Dame Iola took him on her lap and stroked him. He buried his face in the flowers on her bosom and wept until he was too tired to weep any more. That evening, they talked no more. But next day, Bastian brought up the subject again. "Do you know where I can find the water of life?" "On the borders of Fantastica." "I thought Fantastica had no borders." "It has, though. Only they're not outside, but inside. In the place where the childlike empress gets all her power from, but where she herself cannot go." "How am I to find the way there?" asked Bastian. "Isn't it too late?" "There's only one wish that can take you there. Your last." Bastian was terrified. "Dame Iola, all the wishes that have come true thanks to Orin have made me forget something. Will it be the same with this one?" She nodded slowly. "But if I don't notice it..." "Did you notice it the other time? Once you've forgotten something, you don't know you ever had it. What am I forgetting now?" "I'll tell you at the proper time. If I told you now, you'd hold on to it." "Must I lose everything?"